Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Mitt Romney criticized the Obama administration during his victory speech in New Hampshire after the primary there this week. Let's listen to a clip.
This president has enacted job-killing regulations. I'll eliminate them. He lost our AAA credit rating. I'll restore it. He passed Obamacare. I'll repeal it. And when it comes to the economy, my highest priority as president will be worrying about your job, not about saving my own.
Okay, so Mitt Romney seems to, well, he's won both Iowa and New Hampshire. He seems to be the only one focusing on the incumbent right now, the first non-incumbent Republican since 1970s to win Iowa and New Hampshire, by the way. Has he really been tested yet? Joining us now to get at that and so many other questions of politics is NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
So,
A little quick correction, not a correction, but a little update on what you just said.
He's not the only
non-incumbent Republican to win Iowa and New Hampshire since the 1970s. He's the only one in history.
Because
Iowa only began in 1970s.
Of course.
So he's the only one ever, only Republican to win Iowa, win New Hampshire. Now, not every Republican is convinced he won Iowa.
Right.
A lot of people are hinting that maybe there's some chicanery or some numbers. But, being that aside, he's the only Republican, and that's history is important. I will also tell you, and in my nonstop monologue right now, even though I haven't had coffee yet, the last three presidents, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, all lost the New Hampshire primary en route to winning the White House. So maybe that's a bad omen for Mitt Romney.
Is there any primary we look at that's the one that everyone has always won who ends up in the White House?
Well, not so much in the White House, but,
okay.
But every since it was created in 1980, every Republican who has won the South Carolina primary, which comes up on January 21st, has gone on to win the nomination. So some people win Iowa and fail. Some people win New Hampshire and fail. But every Republican who's won South Carolina has won the nomination. So that's the one a lot of people look at as the gold standard.
And it also is expected to be a much tougher test for Mitt Romney.
Well, that goes without saying. One, because everybody's now is aiming at Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. Two, Mitt Romney didn't have an easy go in New Hampshire, even though his victory was pretty impressive. But he had a tough debate Sunday on Meet the Press, the ads, the attacks on him by Gingrich and others about a stewardship of Bain Capital has been really tough, so that's bad too. But South Carolina has a history of dirty politics, gutter politics. 8 years ago, when John McCain was first running, there was a whispering campaign that he had fathered a black child out of wedlock, and of course, he and his wife Cindy adopted a little girl from Bangladesh. So, I mean, that's the latter part of the true part. The black child out of wedlock is a whispering campaign. And it gets very, very ugly in South Carolina. That's the history there.
My guest, if you don't recognize his voice, Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for Ken, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Question for our listeners, is Mitt Romney's career with the private equity firm Bain Capital fair game in the GOP presidential primary and beyond, I suppose? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, and tell us what you think. So it seemed like Newt Gingrich was sort of backing off yesterday, but then he's got, you know, he came out great guns against Romney for his involvement with Bain. He seemed to sort of be backing off, but he blamed the arc of his discussion on Bain, he blamed it on the president.
Well, he did. Yes. And ladies and gentlemen, meet Newt Gingrich. What I think is there's several things happening. First of all, he did back off when somebody came to him at a little rally. I think it was a kid or so, a woman who came over to him and said, "This is hurting the Republican Party." He says, "I agree, this is abhorrent." But that's not going to stop a pro-Gingrich super PAC in South Carolina from spending anywhere between $3 and $5 million trashing Romney day in and day out about Romney's alleged flip-flops on abortion and his tenure at Bain Capital. But in fairness, to Newt, in Iowa, it was super PACs by Mitt Romney that savaged Newt Gingrich. Once upon a time, Newt Gingrich was the front runner. I was just thinking of a cover of the Weekly Standard magazine that showed a picture of Gingrich and called him the comeback kid. Well, that ended in Iowa thanks to a blistering nonstop ad campaign by the pro-Romney forces. So the bad blood continues. But with Gingrich, it seems personal. Gingrich is not going to let it go. You notice with Rick Santorum said, look, sure, we can, you know, I mean, his stewardship at Bain is important because basically he's running on that issue. But for us to attack Bain Capital for, you know, buying up other companies and people being fired, I mean, there's good and bad in capitalism. And for us, meaning the Republicans, for us to be criticizing capitalism or the way capitalism works, we're falling into the hands of what the Democrats are going to do in the fall.
As much as Romney criticized him in his Obama in his victory speech, Gingrich, you know, as we've been talking about, has been criticizing Romney all week. And a commercial run by a pro-Gingrich super PAC raises questions about the Bain Capital, as you mentioned. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports that Gingrich wants answers. Let's listen.
If somebody's going to crumble, they better crumble before the nomination. I mean, you don't want to end up in September with a nominee who's been untested and can't stand it.
He's talking about Mitt Romney. Gingrich talked a lot about Mitt Romney in the last day before the New Hampshire primary.
The fact is, there are legitimate questions. There are going to be more of those questions. At some point, Governor Romney's going to have to answer them.
So would this be better for Romney if he deals with this stuff now versus in the general election, or is there no guarantee it won't be in a general election as well?
Well, of course it'll be in a general election. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like saying President Obama should deal with Reverend Wright in 2008 because the Republicans are not going to mention it in the fall general election. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they did. But, I mean, what could Romney say, basically, other than the fact is that, you know, there was good news and there was bad news. There were some companies that succeeded, some companies failed, and that's by the nature of which is capitalism. Regarding your earlier point that Romney is spending most of his time or all of his time attacking President Obama, that's been Romney's strategy from the very, very beginning. You know, during the early primaries, when there was still a front runner du jour between Rick Perry and then Herman Cain. You remember Herman Cain, that President Herman Cain, and then Newt Gingrich. Mitt Romney still focused on the president, and that has not changed, and especially hasn't changed now that he's won Iowa and New Hampshire.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So you made a point in your blog that the turnout wasn't so great in Iowa, besides that it was just 8 votes separating Romney from Santorum. The turnout wasn't so great. How was it in New Hampshire?
It was similar. Now, I thought that in 2008, with the Republican Party on the defensive about President Bush and the war in Iraq and the faltering economy and the collapse of the financial industry, the Republican Party was pretty dispirited. And yet, in 2012, with the advent of the Tea Party, with the anticipation that they're licking their chops at the thought of defeating President Obama in the fall, and yet the numbers in Iowa and New Hampshire, while better, were marginally better. And I would have thought that if this excitement about what the future is going to bring for the Republicans, I would have thought a bigger turnout was in the making, and it wasn't.
So what do you make of that? Are you expecting a similar turnout in South Carolina?
I don't know what to make of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Iowa, perhaps the part of the problem, there may be two things part of the problem. One, in Iowa, strong evangelical vote, and Mitt Romney's never been a favorite of the evangelicals. In New Hampshire, the feeling from the beginning was that this was Mitt Romney's to lose. He had a huge lead all along, and he never forfeited it. So perhaps maybe there was an excitement, and there really wasn't that much excitement on the ground in New Hampshire because, in the old days, and I love talking about the old days, of course, but in the old days, people were very excited. The New Hampshire primary meant a lot, but when you had a de facto favorite son running, maybe it tamped down turnout. Now, South Carolina is going to be interesting because it is really a hotbed of Republican. It's a true Republican state, unlike Iowa and New Hampshire, which are purple at best. South Carolina is a real Republican state. But again, if it becomes negative, it becomes he said this, you know, he said that, and it's back and forth negative stuff, that could also hurt turnout as well.
A prevailing sense among New Hampshire primary voters is that when he's the most likely to defeat Barack Obama in November. Is that the same logic? Do you think that will come into play at all in South Carolina, or will they stick to their strong conservative point of view and vote in whoever they feel fits that bill?
You know, a lot of people say that South Carolina is a very, very conservative state, and it is. They say it's a very pro-military state, and it is. But also, it's really a pretty much an establishment state in that sometimes when Iowa does, you know, I'm putting quotes around these words, weird things like Mike Huckabee winning or Rick Santorum really winning or even Pat Robertson really doing well, that doesn't happen. Those candidates don't do well in South Carolina. Similarly, in 1996, when Pat Buchanan won the New Hampshire primary in 2000, when the establishment choice of George W. Bush was clobbered by John McCain, both McCain and Buchanan, those guys didn't do well in South Carolina. So for all its reputation of being a very conservative state, it still likes to right the course. And if the course is not going the right way, in other words, towards victory in November, South Carolina often changes that. And that's why everybody who's won South Carolina has gone on to win the nomination. Even if that may not be the most conservative candidate, John McCain was hardly the most conservative candidate in 2008. George W. Bush may not have been the most conservative candidate in 2000, but they were the right candidates for the Republican Party, and ultimately they went on to win the nomination.
My guest, once again, Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A question to listeners, do you think something like the Bain issue will play out and make a difference, and should it? You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Detroit wants to turn your car into a rolling internet connection. We'll look at cars as the web on wheels. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. 42 degrees with cloudy skies. Expect rain showers off and on throughout the day and a high right around 46. And then temperatures will be falling pretty drastically. A rain-snow mix is likely tonight, and then some snow showers overnight, a low of 23 degrees. Expect some snow for Friday, little to no accumulation, but a high of just 26, and still a chance of snow Friday night, and much colder than we've been used to, a low of 15 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. We're talking about Republican primary politics. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Paul in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann, Ken, as fed up as I am with politics.
Don't say that.
I'm sorry, Ken, but it is getting a little overwhelming.
Yeah.
But I'll try to be concise. I think the public could use a primer on the whole Bain issue. I'm just going to be brief. As my understanding, it's a private equity firm, and typically, or at least in this case, these equity firms go and buy up a company or gain control of it and load it up with debt. Frequently enriching themselves either through transaction benefits or bonuses, and then break it apart and ultimately Workers are either left unemployed or are left with lower-value jobs. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Well, I think, Paul, that's my understanding, too. It's not something that will I'd like to have on a resume or on a bumper sticker as I'm running for president. But at the same time, it is exactly what part of the private equity business is. But at the same time, Romney said that in his stewardship as a businessman, he's also taken other companies like Sports Authority, for example, and others he's mentioned, and done well with it. Now, is it a legitimate issue, as Anne is asking? Absolutely, sure it is. Everything's a legitimate issue. Everything from the moment you're born is a legitimate issue in politics, and sometimes even the illegitimate issues become a little legitimate. But having said that, and I think, there are a lot of Republicans who feel this way, said, look, there's a lot of things to get on Mitt Romney for. Romney care, the so-called flip-flops on abortion and social issues, that's fine. But to take out the tenets of capitalism, for better or for worse, I mean, there are a lot of bad things in capitalism, too, and people will agree on that. But to do – and now this sounds like I'm a Romney apologist here, and I am not, but I'm saying to do Obama's dirty work during the primaries, it could be self-defeating for the Republicans in November, But is it a legitimate issue? Absolutely, and Romney knows that.
Steve in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hello. I just have a musical comment. for Mr. Romney. It's from Wizard of Oz and the Scarecrow's song. I would cut employee hours till the venture sours, another company down the drain. And the plant, I'd be scratching, padlocks would be a latching if I only had a bane.
All right, Steve.
The second verse is actually better, but that's enough.
Be it for me to groan at bad jokes, but I kind of like that. I say if this doesn't work in the Gingrich campaign, I say American Idol is the answer.
Okay, Steve, don't quit, as they say.
Don't quit your day job. Right?
Okay. Terry in Columbus, welcome to the show.
Is it me, Terry?
It's you, Terry. Thanks. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'd like to say to Ken, he's one of America's punniest commentators.
Thank you, I think.
Okay, and my question is, do you think that Mitt Romney is really as moderate as his critics say he is? I don't think he is.
Well, that's a very good question. In other words, I mean, that's very interesting because when he ran, and I've said this before, when he ran for the Senate against Ted Kennedy in 1994, when he ran for governor of Massachusetts in 2002, he was pro-choice. He was pro-stem cell research. He was not into, I think he said he would be more fair about gay rights than Ted Kennedy was. And, of course, the conservative right loves to bring that up. When he decided, like, 06 or so, that he was running for president in 08, he became very, very vocal on social issues. Now, the question that was asked then, was he as conservative as he was saying he was? I mean, what's the true Mitt Romney? Is it the fact that he was a moderate who would be willing to talk about gay rights and choice? Or is he a true social conservative who had to sound moderate by running for office in Massachusetts? That's the question people don't really know. And I think that's the ultimate weakness in Romney's candidacy.
But I just don't believe he's very conservative. If he doesn't believe he's very moderate, if he doesn't believe in taxing the richest Americans.
Well, but he has to say that. I mean, suddenly John Huntsman, and we'll talk about him in a second. But John Huntsman is seen as a moderate in this campaign. He is hardly moderate. I mean, right. The only thing he's ever said that seems moderate is that he thinks that civil unions are okay, not same sex marriage, but civil unions. If that's what makes somebody moderate, yikes. You wonder, everybody says, would Ronald Reagan survive in this Republican Party climate? And people wonder about that. Reagan has raised taxes. He's been kind of sympathetic to gay rights. He was not, he was not a fire-breathing social conservative despite his reputation. And as there are more and more absolutists who say that the party has to turn this way and not divert from that, you wonder how a candidate can turn around and try to appeal to independent voters in the general election. And, again, that is another thing that the Republicans have to worry about.
Thanks, Terry. You brought up former Utah Governor John Huntsman. He's been described as one of the most moderate candidates, period, and he finished third in New Hampshire. In this clip, he talks about continuing on.
And here we sit tonight, ladies and gentlemen, with a ticket to ride and to move on. Here we go to South Carolina. Thank you all so very much.
You know, it might get harder for him as they move to South Carolina. We've been talking about that already. But he did get a little bit of a bump in New Hampshire, I thought.
I say not.
Really?
I disagree. I mean, and I said this before, that, you know, the line after Ticket to Ride in the Beatles song was, "But She Don't Care." And I don't think people care. It was one thing for Bill Clinton in 1992 to lose New Hampshire and say, "I'm the comeback kid." I mean, that was a part of some masterful spin, but it worked. I mean, people thought that he would lose, and he came in close to post longest, and he became the comeback kid, even though he lost. For him to say that this is a great victory, first of all, John Huntsman bypassed Iowa. He didn't even compete in Iowa because he basically moved to New Hampshire and make his case there. Hmm. New Hampshire allows independents to vote, and a lot of independents voted, obviously, in the Republican primary on Tuesday. And he tried, you know, he talked about we have to get out of Afghanistan now, and again, that doesn't have to necessarily be a liberal position, but he was trying to appeal to independents. To get 16.7% of the vote in third place, well behind Ron Paul, and we haven't talked about Ron Paul either, but well behind Ron Paul and the winner, Mitt Romney, I think was pretty bad. Where does he go from there? Does he go to South Carolina, where he has no organization? Does he go to Florida on January 31st, which is so expensive? I mean, you know, I think some people say that maybe he's running for 2016 or what, but all I know is that in New Hampshire, there was a tremendous lot of buzz for John Huntsman after the Sunday debate on Meet the Press when he really went after Romney. And to see 16%, a weak third place finish, to me, that wasn't a ticket to ride.
614-292-8513. We're talking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to talk with Ken Rudin. So Ron Paul came in third in New Hampshire.
Second in
New Hampshire.
You're part of the media staff.
I don't know what's wrong with me.
Yeah, right.
4 years ago, he lasted as a candidate until mid-June. I think you pointed that out in one of your blogs. What are your predictions for him this time?
Well, I don't think I have a prediction, only because he is showing much more strength. I mean, 4 years ago, as I've said many times, it's a lifetime ago for the Republican Party. 4 years ago, I think he got 8% in New Hampshire, and now he got 25%. We always say that Ron Paul's supporters are very fervent. They're not going to, you know, waver between one candidate or the other. They'll stick with him, you know, through and through. And we also said that, but he's very strong in caucuses where they organize really well and will not do as well in primaries. Well, the fact is, just like Mitt Romney has been running ever since 2008, Ron Paul's been running ever since 2008. He had a strong organization. And to me, 25% is pretty sizable. Now, the question is, does he get 25% along with the 25% and he gets in a 5 or 6 man field? Does he also get 25% when it's him and Romney one-on-one? And that's the question we have to answer, because Ron Paul is not going to leave the race anytime soon. He doesn't flip-flop on positions. He feels that the other Republicans are unacceptable, certainly on war, certainly on the Fed's money policy, certainly on constitutional liberties. And there's a lot to be made in that argument. And so what we're sitting and waiting and wondering is is it a solid 25% no matter what the case is? And again, 25% is very impressive in a 6-candidate field. It's less so impressive in a 2-candidate field, but I'm not predicting what he's going to get. It's just something to watch.
The observation has been made that he's not saying when I'm president. He's just saying as we move forward, and meaning the point being that maybe he's not necessarily expecting to be president, but maybe creating something even bigger like a third party.
Well, he's been asked a million times whether he's going to run as a Libertarian Party nominee, which he did in 1988 when he was out of Congress, and he says it's not my intention. Now, everybody says, well, that's not a solid no. He doesn't have to give a solid no. There are no definites in anything. I mean, that's what people love to say. Well, if you're wavering on it, that means you're probably thinking about it. First of all, the question is what he does, what he wants to do. Does he think he's going to be president? No, but let's be honest. does, if Newt Gingrich thinks he's going to be president, if Rick Santorum thinks he's going to be president, then I probably would worry more about them than I would about Ron Paul, who probably knows he's not going to be president. Sometimes you run for president to present a cause, to make an argument, to make it, to have a voice in what is not being said or heard in the campaign. Now, Ron Paul has said some, honestly, some wacky things. He said some very sensible things as well. He still says what other people are not saying, and whether he thinks he's going to win or not is not the point. I mean, the case for Ron Paul is that he's saying things that other candidates are not saying, and if you believe in it, you vote for him, and then maybe he can have some kind of effect either on the platform or at the convention. But the latest rumor I heard was that he turned 77 years old this year, which is, I'm not an ageist kind of person, but I mean that's pretty elderly for somebody who's about to take over the presidency. But the latest rumor is now he's paving the way for his son Rand Paul to become the new Ron Paul in 2016 or 2020. I can't believe we're talking about 2016 and 2020, but he's a fascinating guy. I keep getting emails all the time about how the media is doing a cover-up about Ron Paul. They're refusing to cover him. I've talked more about Ron Paul in the past 6 months, than I've talked about Ann Fisher in the last 6 months.
Oh, my God.
I know, that's pretty frightening.
Garth in Whitehall. Welcome to the show, Garth.
Hey, welcome. Good morning. I guess I have a question. When I watch all these shows on television and you see all the debates and everything going on, the one thing you don't see in 90% of these audiences, if not even greater than 90%, is the number of black people. Why is it that these candidates always go to any city they go to, or any town they go to, any state, it's always your upper middle white class or your rich white folks? Go to an average middle class black neighborhood and give a debate and see what we think. No one cares. Why?
Well, you can make the case that people do care, but just caring and making something happen are not the same thing. Jack Kemp talked a ton about empowerment and the African American community, and that they should not, neither party should own the black vote. And he talked about it a day until he was blue in the face. And of course, it did them no good. But then you also have, candidates, Republican candidates, who come out and say, well, I'm not sure I would have supported the 1964 Civil Rights Act, or I think we should seal up the fence and don't let anybody of a different color in the country. They're not saying those exact words, but that's a theme that comes out of a lot of the candidates. So, look, first of all, Iowa, Iowa and New Hampshire is not known as vestiges of African-American communities. There is no black vote in Iowa and New Hampshire. Matter of fact, I think the only minority I ran into in New Hampshire was a Democrat. I mean, that's as far as I got with minorities. That was a bad joke. I'm sorry. But the thing is, but you're absolutely right, because when the nomination comes into Florida, South Carolina has one of the largest black populations in the country, but they don't vote in Republican primaries. So the Republicans can say, well, why should I make an effort to reach out to African-American voters when they don't vote Republicans? Vote Republican. But, of course, black voters can say, well, wait a second. We're not going to vote Republican until you give us a reason to. And so far we haven't seen a reason. So both sides, it's like a chicken and egg thing, and it's frustrating because there's going to be an outreach towards Hispanic voters in the fall by the Republican Party. But if you listen to the rhetoric about immigration and the borders and things like that, it's hard to see how the Latino vote could possibly vote Republican. That's one of the tasks they have in front of them.
Thank you.
Just wondered, and I have one other question for you. What do you think we as black race feel about some of these debates? As we sit back and we watch this, and just like they made the comment one time several months back, they said, what if the person doesn't have insurance, do you let them die? And the audience went crazy and clapped. But you know what? There's almost as many white people that doesn't have health insurance as black, if not more. And, I hear these things and I watch these things and I listen. And as a black American and also a fellow Marine, I've done my time in the Marine Corps as well, it hurts me to see how much the Republicans literally don't care, in my opinion, about anything other than the wealthy Americans who are predominantly your white male.
And you know,
and that's huge.
And you know what's interesting? After President Obama was elected, the Republican Party, I don't know if this was deliberate or not or conscious or not, but Michael Steele was elected Republican National Chairman. And to put a black, I think I'm being a little stark here, and I don't mean to be as stark as I'm sounding, but this is live radio, but it seems to me to put a black face on a Republican National Chairman is not the same thing as saying, well, we care about African-American voters and African-American concerns, because blacks and whites are suffering from lack of jobs. Blacks and whites are suffering from lack of job training. Blacks and whites know that their economic future is hanging in the balance, and these things should not be race issues. It should be everything, but I think there's a calculation out there that, you know, if you're going to get the nomination, you have to go where the votes are. And in the battle for the nomination, tragically, the African-American community is not part of that calculation.
Thank you, Garth, for that call. Speaking of black Republicans, we have an email from Joan. She writes, a week from today, Herman Cain is addressing the Southern Republican Leadership Conference in Charleston, South Carolina, and it's rumored he'll make a surprising endorsement. Any guesses as to what it will be and how it will affect the primary race?
Well, you know, I was in New Hampshire twice in the past 2 weeks, and Fox News had a bulletin on their ticker that Todd Palin endorsed Newt Gingrich, and I was so excited I almost dropped my bong. I mean, I don't know. What does that mean? I don't think endorsements mean anything anymore, especially Herman Cain, who I think left the campaign so discredited. A lot of people said. A lot of people say, well, we're picking on Herman Cain. A lot of conservatives said we're picking on Herman Cain because he's African-American. That's insane. I mean, we'll pick on John Edwards. We'll pick on Bill Clinton, anybody who has these kind of foibles. And this is more than just foibles. It's not just, twice his company paid somebody to drop harassment charges. There has to be something there. I mean, if 999 were the number of women he assaulted, that's not a good thing. So I kind of think that for people to hold their breath on an endorsement from Herman Cain, who left, I think, the campaign in a cloud. It's regrettable that there are so few persons of color who represent the Republican Party. Colin Powell could have been at one point, but he was disillusioned, and ultimately in 2008 he endorsed Barack Obama. You do have two black House members from South Carolina and Florida on the Republican side, which is pretty remarkable. But for the most part, it's what you see is what you get.
And speaking of scandals and so forth, when we come back, we're going to hear from Delbert. He wants to talk about that issue. My guest, Ken Rudin, he's NPR's political junkie, and he will be with us when we return as well. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and you can help shorten our upcoming winter membership drive. Become a sustaining member right now. For every 100 sustaining members we receive, we will eliminate one day from our drive. As a sustaining member of 89.7 NPR News, your membership never expires. No more reminders in the mail, and your member card renews annually. But right now, you can help take one day off of our upcoming drive. Just visit WOSU.org, find out more information, and make your sustaining gift today. And thank you for your support. And it's 43 degrees in downtown Columbus. Rain showers off and on throughout the day, cloudy skies, and a high of 46. A rain-snow mix is likely tonight as temperatures drop, a low of 23 degrees. Expect some snow showers for Friday, little to no accumulation, but a high of just 26 degrees. And then a chance of snow Friday night and a cold night, a low of 15. Mostly cloudy, looking ahead to Saturday, and a high of 28. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm talking with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. You can talk to Ken, too. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And once again, speaking of scandals, Delbert from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what I wanted to ask Ken was, out of the last six presidents, which one did not have a major scandal behind him? And what I'm trying to get at is the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. So which one of them didn't have a major scandal, and what was the scandal? You know, and what I'm trying to do is give people a view of really how the Republicans act so different than the Democrats. And lots of times I notice Ken, they would say stuff like, it happens on both sides, but the Democrats are totally different than Republicans.
Well, I mean, look, you know, you had Reagan, you had Iran-Contra, Clinton, you had Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky. I mean, I think both are equal opportunity abusers of the system. Are you saying, it's not that Republicans are bad and Democrats are bad. There are individual Democrats and there are individual Republicans who are bad and who have gone in scandal. I mean, for every Bob Ney or Tom DeLay or Abramoff, you have Bill Jefferson or you have Charlie Rangel. So, I mean, both parties abuse the law and sometimes they get caught. I mean, John Edwards, my goodness, I mean, he was having a mistress while he was trying to get on the ticket. I mean, if John Edwards had gotten on the 2008 ticket and that affair exploded in like October of 2008, I mean, that would be the end of the Democrats' hope. So, I mean, both parties are reckless. Both parties violate common sense. A lot of it is just common sense. But I don't know if one party has is more pure than the other.
Thank you, Delbert.
But I'd like to know what Delbert is thinking about. Like, does he think that one party is better or cleaner than the other?
Call back, Delbert.
Oh, sorry.
That's
sorry.
Okay. Mark in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Ken, so you were saying that you feel like you talk about Ron Paul a lot, and I appreciate that, and I know that the media is talking about him more now that he placed a close third and second in New Hampshire. But it seems like, just like you did earlier, you had the caveat then of, well, but he probably can't win, or, you know, he might be trying to get his ideas across, but he probably can't win. But I feel like, especially with Ron Paul, that's been the story all along. No matter how he's been doing in the polls or how he did after Iowa, everybody says, well, but he probably can't win.
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I don't know. I just think that that's not very fair. And even recently, when there were some recent polls, I think it was a CBS poll, they had a graphic up on the screen, and it went, you know, Mitt Romney in first, and then they completely skipped Ron Paul, and then they went to, like, Gingrich, Santorum, and Perry. And, you know, so, I mean, you still see stuff like that, and it seems kind of unfair. It seems like they were, you know, it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well,
like,
I think what you're making is a very, very good point, and I'll give another example. The Iowa straw poll, Michelle Bachmann won it by a vote or two or eight, whatever it was, over Ron Paul. Everybody talked about Michelle Bachmann's huge victory in the Iowa straw poll. Nobody talked about Ron Paul's strong second-place finish, and then everybody talked about Tim Pawlenty, who finished third and ultimately dropped out of the race the next day. I probably, if I could do it all over again, I probably wouldn't want to say he can't win, because I know that drove the Paul people nuts in 2008. It's like, I mean, we could have said John McCain can't win. I mean, he doesn't know what's going on with the economy. His numbers are bad, the Republican numbers, so no Republican. But to single out Ron Paul, I think, has the potential of being a self-fulfilling prophecy. And somebody like myself, who is conscious of what the media should be saying and shouldn't be saying, I probably felt guilty as part of that. And so I would probably take that back. Do I think he will win? No. Do I think Santorum will win? No. Do I think Gingrich and Huntsman and Brick Perry and everybody else, do I think they'll win? No, at least the nomination. But again, as I said, when the first call came in about Ron Paul, I no longer make predictions about him, because we keep thinking we know what we're going to see, and he surprised us all year. He surprised us in the Iowa straw poll, a very strong third in Iowa, a very strong second in New Hampshire. So let's just see what happens. But again, for you know, Washington hotshots to come on and say, oh, he's unelectable, that drives me nuts, and I just felt guilty. You know, I felt part of that guilt as well, and I apologize for that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. So do you think that the media overall has been kind of down on him from the start?
Or, I do. Or, I do. And
how do we combat that? Because it just seems like then the media, which, you know, the major news channels and everything is the major source that people consult. Maybe people are looking at more stuff online, but even the major online media spots, there seems to be that angle where they kind of like picked their winner from the start. Like everybody liked Romney from the start, or, you know, they gave a little bit of weight to the other candidates, but they never gave weight to certain candidates.
Well, there's truth to that. I mean, for example, if you think of all the, if you think of the anybody but Mitt Romney coalition that the conservatives are trying to establish, you had Michelle Bachmann as the front runner for a while. Then Rick Perry was the front runner. Then Herman Cain, then Newt Gingrich. And then Rick Santorum became the flavor after he did so well in Iowa. But nobody mentioned Ron Paul. I don't know if it's a combination of the fact, as I say, that he's 76, he'll be 77 years old later this year. I don't know if, I mean, he's talked about legalization. I mean, look, he's a true libertarian, and, you know, God bless him. But at the same time, to talk about legalization of heroin and, you know, pulling out of all troops, that may be fine, and a lot of people may agree with it, but that's not a Republican. The Republican Party has never been like that. I mean, it'll be interesting that when George Bush was president and, you know, Iraq, let's go for it. Afghanistan, let's go for it. And suddenly war is bad when Obama is president. I mean, that seems kind of disingenuous. But he still makes sense on you know, on the Patriot Act and individual liberties. And explain to me how the war in Iraq has made the world safer. And explain to me how the war in Afghanistan has made the world safer. I'm not saying it is. At the same time, he says he wouldn't have gone in and went after Osama bin Laden. To me, that was a big success. It didn't curtail the war. It's not going to probably affect the war. But, you know, when you want to go after one of the most despicable human beings on the face of the earth for what he engineered on 9/11, you know, I think the country says getting Osama is the right thing to do. And in his defense, he says, look, you just don't go after people like that without a declaration of war. He also talks about to say that we cannot have, you know, there should be no wars without Congress declaring war. But we both know, we all know, that the last time Congress did that was in 1941. Korea, Vietnam, the both Gulf Wars were not acts of Congress. They were presidential initiatives that later got backed by Congress. Now, to his credit, Ron Paul says, well, maybe this is wrong, but I don't know if that's the majority feeling in the country. That's all I'm saying. I think there are some positions he's taken that certainly has put him out on the edge. There are certain positions also that made sense. But knowing what I think I understand about this Republican Party electorate, he has a strong bunch of support, but not enough to win the nomination. But then again, I will say that about every other candidate right now except Mitt Romney. That was a very long answer, and I'm trying to think as I'm going along because my mind has gone a tremendous sea change on Ron Paul between 08 and 2012.
Thank you, Mark, for that call. We appreciate it.
That was the longest answer in the history of radio, by the way.
I don't know. Gave me some time to relax.
you went out and saw a movie. How was the movie?
Right. Let's see. From Doug on Facebook, he asks, how did Occupy Wall Street movement get into all these candidates in the GOP primary all of the sudden? Gingrich's super PAC made a 27-minute ad against Romney's record as a job destroyer. Huntsman said recently that he'd break up the big banks. Perry's running against Wall Street and vulture capitalists.
Well, I credit not so much Occupy Wall Street as I credit the fact that Mitt Romney is the guy everybody wants to beat. And if you want to run against Mitt Romney, you run against him from two directions. Either his flip-flopping, so-called flip-flopping on the issues, his Romney care, including his health care plan when he was governor of Massachusetts, or you attack his Wall Street connections. It sounds very odd to hear Republicans attacking Wall Street, but again, if you want to stop Mitt Romney, I don't know how else you do it, but attacking all things Mitt Romney, that should be a good Ann Fisher show, all things Mitt Romney. But the way to do it is go after his Wall Street connections, well, and that does sound very much like Occupy Wall Street.
Well, someone likened it to Michael Moore. Newt Gingrich sounded like Michael Moore, and I thought, yeah, exactly.
And a lot of people,
wow.
A lot of people confuse the two of them. It's very
interesting. Yes. An email from, well, let's go to a tweet from Jason, because I want to know the answer to this question, too. I want to hear Ken's opinion of dumping Biden and the possibility of an Obama-Clinton ticket a la Hillary Clinton, who doesn't want to be Secretary of State anymore.
Well, she doesn't want to be Secretary of State anymore because she's burnt out. I think it's very interesting. When she was running for president, she was a polarizing figure. Half the Democrats loved her, and a lot of the Democrats did not like her, and all the Republicans hated her. But as Secretary of State, she is one of the most, if not the most admired woman in the country. I mean, given what's going on this planet, I think she's doing an amazing job as Secretary of State. Having said that, we always seem to want to – first of all, there's two things. The media love to create a story. On Talk of the Nation yesterday, we had Bill Keller, the former executive editor of the New York Times, now a columnist, who said the real way for President Obama to win re-election is to give Joe Biden the Secretary of State job that Hillary Clinton is going to give up, since Joe Biden was longtime Foreign Relations Committee chairman in the Senate, and then Hillary Clinton will be on the ticket as vice president and the heir apparent for 2016. I mean, it sounds so. It's one. It sounds like the media are so lazy and so bored, and so unexcited about a Romney versus Obama contest that may be sewn up, sooner than we know it. And if that's the case, let's make something exciting about it. And two, if you think of the vice presidents that weren't dumped, who was so controversial, Spiro Agnew in 1972, Dan Quayle mm-hmm. in 1992. And Joe Biden, I mean, he may be a gaffe machine. I mean, he may talk longer than Ken Rudin sometimes, which is pretty frightening. But I mean, he's not damaging the ticket. And basically, as I've also argued, look, President Obama is going to be reelected or not, depending on the economy in this country. If we're still at 8%, moving up to 9% unemployment, if jobs are not being created, if there's pessimism about the future. You know, having Ann Fisher on the ticket is not going to help. Well, it might, but it probably would hurt in Ohio. But but the thing is, it's not about a vice president. You know, Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman. Oh my goodness! And Mondale Ferraro loses 49 out of 50 states. The VP is not that effective and important in winning things. And with Hillary Clinton, you bring up, if the Republican Party is not fired up enough, all this love fest that you're hearing about the Republicans and Hillary Clinton will dissipate the moment she's named on the ticket. And we'll hear about Whitewater and Monica and Bill's shenanigans and all that stuff.
Because she is formidable in a way?
Well, she's certainly formidable. Mm-hmm. I mean, she lost the Democratic nomination by an eyelash in mm-hmm. one of the most exciting primary contests in history. But you don't need to put somebody like that on the ticket to win. You need to improve the economy. Now, Obama could say, well, I'm trying, but the Republican Party is stopping me at every, and the American people will decide on that argument. But I don't know. It's just hard to make that case. The last vice president ever dumped from the ticket. Well, first of all, Nelson Rockefeller was let go in 76, but he wasn't ever elected. But the last elected vice president was Henry Wallace in 1944. I mean, you just don't dump vice presidents that willy-nilly. And again, as I say, if Obama is in trouble, if the economy is in the toilet, nobody on the ticket is going to help him. But if the economy is improving, and if he could make this the case of my solutions for and the Republican Party's solutions, then he has a shot, of course.
We haven't really talked very much about him, but Rick Perry decided to stay in it.
Who?
Yeah, right. Okay.
The funny thing is that Rick Perry was going to be the alternative to Mitt Romney. He's a great campaigner. He's a ferocious campaigner. He raises a ton of money. But he completely, completely fell apart in those series of debates, the famous oops quote, and he has not recovered. And, of course, on the night of the Iowa caucuses, to say that I'm going back to Texas to reassess my candidacy, and everybody says, well, okay, he's leaving. And then he says, no, I'm going to give it another shot in South Carolina. Well, nobody votes for a candidate who's going to give it another shot. If he's serious about this, then, he would not reassess anything. And, I don't take too much importance in the 1% that he got in New Hampshire because he really bypassed the state. But a fifth place, sixth place finish in Iowa. I think it was fifth place, and then Michelle Bachmann was sixth. Mm-hmm. Those are weak showings, and it's one of the, there are a lot of surprises in 2011, 2012. Rick Perry's collapse is one of them.
So just something I want to get at real quick before the end of the show, the money in the game is amazing this time around. Newt Gingrich's side just received a $5 million check from a casino mogul via one of those super PACs, one of the ones that's endorsing him.
Be careful. He did not get that money.
Right.
That money went to the super PAC, right?
But getting to that point, this is the first election cycle since the Citizens United case that made the donor rules the same for individuals and corporations. How might that change the complexion of the 2012 cycle? Are you expecting anything bigger anything really different, or is it just going to be bigger, bigger, bigger?
It is bigger, 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 but it is a tremendous difference in the sense that, you know, everybody says, well, Barack Obama is going to have a $1 billion campaign. He already raised $68 million in the fourth quarter of 2011, $42 million going to his campaign, $24 to the DNC. That's a lot of money. Romney only raised $24 million, which is still a lot, still a ton of money, but $24 million. But you know that those super PACs out there, the American Crossroads, those groups that don't have to identify the donors, they will be spending no Republican, don't feel sorry for the Republican Party right away. No Republican is going to be vastly outspent by the Obama campaign because of all these super PACs. And if you don't have money you don't have that money, you're not going to be competitive, and Republicans know that.
And then just really quick, because we're running out of time, lots of shakeup at the White House, departure of William Daley from the chief of staff perch. One of Obama's senior aides has been tapped to run the Domestic Policy Council, which manages national domestic policy. It's pretty typical stuff at this point.
No.
Okay.
Daley was brought on to help Obama with the Republicans in Congress and Wall Street. That is not working, and since Obama's going to be running against Republicans and Wall Street, Bill Daley was not the right guy in that job.
Okay, well, Ken Rudin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, thanks for your calls and letters. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
So long to go through the crowded streets of your mighty London.
Actor Gary Oldman is so good at what he does, you might not recognize him from role to role. From his campy portrayal of Dracula to Sirius Black in Harry Potter, and now George Smiley in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Gary Oldman on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Palmer Miller Nelson Insurance Agency, Incorporated, serving Central Ohio homeowners and businesses since 1855. More information at 261-6300 or online at pmnins.com.
You can help shorten the upcoming 89.7 NPR News winter membership drive. Become a sustaining member. For every 100 sustaining members we receive, we will eliminate one day from our drive. Just visit WOSU.org and make that sustaining gift right now. 43 degrees with cloudy skies in downtown Columbus. Light rain today and a high of 46. A rain-snow mix tonight and a low of 23. Good morning. It's 11 o'clock.
Are we to be friends, then?
We are allies, my dear, which can be a good deal more effective.
That's Dame Maggie Smith as Dowager Countess of Grantham, delivering one of her zingers in the hit series Downton Abbey, now in its second season on public television. The critically acclaimed period drama is attracting the highest ratings ever for PBS and won 6 primetime Emmys last year. Today on All Sides, the executive producer of PBS Masterpiece talks about the world of Downton Abbey. Later on in the hour, what Martin Luther King Jr. learned from Gandhi. Join us after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/AllSides.